I started out to do something that would benefit my family. And as a result of many good fortunes and many wonderful people that I've met along the way, I have been able to provide my family with educations and experiences that I never had.
In a country in an era riven by racial oppression and struggle, it's impossible to find a single person who can embody those times. But there is one man who comes close. John W. Barfield, born to poor southern sharecroppers, who went on to build a billion-dollar international business, a family business.
John Barfield is a really impressive serial entrepreneur. I mean, he's got deep entrepreneurial genes in him. You know, here's a guy who had a newspaper route. He was a door-to-door salesman. He worked as a janitor. He's an irrepressible presence that has to succeed at entrepreneurial ventures.
Businessmen are made. Entrepreneurs are born. And if you bring this back to John Barfield, he's an entrepreneur. He was born entrepreneur.
He's a gentle soul, but he has the eye of the tiger. He is truly the American dream.
My father was an extraordinary man. He was big and a powerful physique and was maybe the kindest person I've ever known. He was too kind to even spank my sister and I. That was a job that my mother had to do. They taught us a lot of principles, and I've been asked why they taught you these principles. That these were principles that were designed to protect us from God and man. Living in the South where we did, you could be lynched for nothing. We thought that Pennsylvania would be better. We found that Pennsylvania, for my folks, was almost as bad. My father had to work almost as hard there as he did in the South.
Some blues are just blues, mine are the miner's blues.
It was not the best lifestyle. Most of the coal mines paid you in script. You know, they're working 12, 14-hour days, and sometimes more than that. The life expectancy wasn't very high. There were deaths on a daily basis in most of these mines. It was probably the harshest of all the industries.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is John Barfield, and I've lived in this area since I was 15 years old. And I'm delighted that you came today to hear about my story. Let me just start by telling you that 40 years ago, I proposed to our local Ypsilanti Rotary Club that we raise enough money to vaccinate 1 million children from polio. They said, okay, John, if you will agree to lead the effort, we will do it. So I agreed. And at the end of 2 years, we had raised enough money to vaccinate 497,000 children. We missed our goal by 500,000. So when I wrote the book, I was down in Florida, and I went to a bookstore, and I said, how much royalty would there be for a $27 hardcover book? And they said $4.50. And I said, okay, thank you. So I decided that I would sell my books in another way, and that I would give all of the money to the Rotary Foundation to provide vaccinations for another 500,000 children throughout the world. I thought it was better to give my money to a cause like that than to give it to people who were already very rich, and I thought it was a little like exploitation. So I proposed this to the Rotary Foundation, and they were delighted to hear this. And they called me back later and said, Mr. Barfield, we want you to know that we proposed this to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and they've decided to give you $30 for every $15 that you contribute. So when you buy one of my books, $45 will go to the Rotary Foundation to provide polio vaccinations for children all over the world. And it's my goal to raise enough money to vaccinate another 500,000 children and complete the goal that I started 40 years ago with our Rotary Club. And I'm pleased to tell you that we're on target. And in September, we will go to the Rotary Foundation in Evanston, and we will give them a check for $90,000, and that check will provide polio vaccinations for another 500,000 children, and I will have completed the goal that I started 40 years ago. So it took me 40 years to do it, but we did it. I thought I'd talk a little while and then maybe give you some time to ask me a few questions, and I can try my best to answer those for you. I've been an entrepreneur for 65 years. When I was about 5 years old, living in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, I became deathly ill. Nobody knew what my illness was, but my family had gathered every day. They had moved my room from the middle of the house to the front room, and that was because I could get more air flowing through the house. We lived in what some people call a shotgun house. They call it a shotgun house because you could stand at the front door and look all the way through the house to the backyard. The reason for that was that all the doors were in line with each other. So they said you could stand at the front door and shoot someone in the backyard. But anyway, I was laying there very, very sick. Nothing they did seemed to help. I just got sicker and sicker. So one day, as they gathered around my bed, crying and praying and applying medicines and whatever they could do, two ladies walked down the street. Now, this was very unusual because this was in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, which was known to be one of the most prejudicial places in the world at that time. And these two ladies were white. So they walked into this black community and walked down the street and up on my front porch and without knocking walked into the house and up to the bed. I was lying in the bed, my father said, and they walked up and they looked at my mother and father and said, "You've got a very sick baby." And one of the ladies took out a piece of paper and a pencil and wrote an address and said to my father, "Run as fast as you can to this house and give this to the man living there." Now, my father had been a sharecropper all of his life, had hardly any education, and certainly didn't have a car. So he ran all the way from the colored section of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, to the white section. And he knocked on the door, and he found a man, a white man, sitting inside of the room. And the man invited him in, and he gave him the note. The man read the note and got up and packed a bag and got on a motorcycle and came down through the black section of Tuscaloosa where I lived as fast as he could go. And my father always laughed when he told me this story. He said, "Johnny, I didn't have a car, but I got there at the same time he did." I think this was because my father knew what backyards to run through and where the dogs would bite and where they wouldn't bite. But they came in, and the man said to my mother and grandmother, "I want you to make me a pot of strong black coffee," which they did. And he sat beside my bed all that night. And the next morning, my fever had broken. This was a doctor. And my father said, "In 3 or 4 days, Johnny, you were out in the backyard playing as if nothing had ever happened." And I said, "Daddy, who were these people?" He said, "Johnny, I don't know who these two ladies were." He said, "Nobody in our community had ever seen them before, and no one has seen them since." He said, "We all came to the conclusion that these were two angels that God had sent to save your life." And he said, "Johnny, we believe that God has a purpose for your life." And I do too, and I think God has a purpose for all of our lives. It's up to us to decide what our purpose is. I think I've decided what my purpose is. I think my purpose was to be an entrepreneur, to be a person that created jobs for a lot of people. I'm going to tell you about a company that I have now that I started in 1975 with 6 employees, and we've since grown to 650 employees. We operate in 20 countries. We provide training service to 35,000 employees of some of the largest corporations in the world. We manage $4.2 billion of client funds. We're responsible for those every day. And in 2014, we were named the best managed services corporation in the country. The reason that is important is because it started when I was 15 years old. I made a very serious mistake. I quit school when I was 16, and I joined the Army. It was something about the uniform that was exciting. And I found myself on my 17th birthday on my way across the Atlantic on a Liberty ship bound for Le Havre, France. I got to France, and from there I went to Munich, and from there I went to Nuremberg, where I became a military policeman until I was discharged. I came back to this country at the age of 19 with no skills and no training that provided me with a good job. So I took a job as a wall washer at Angel Hall down the street there, and I washed walls at Angel Hall. At the end of the wall washing season, they offered janitorial positions for some of the janitors, and I was one of the people that was offered a job. And my job for the next 6 years was as a janitor at the chemistry building up across from the Women's League. Now, I worked there for 6 years, from 1949 to 1954, and I was paid, at the end of my experience, $2 an hour. I started at $1.75 an hour. I made $2 an hour. And then I married a beautiful girl, probably the most beautiful girl any of you have ever seen. and honest, people used to say, John, your wife looks like Lena Horne. And I said, no, Lena Horne looks like my wife. But anyway, we've been married 68 years. She was my girlfriend 5 years before. So I tell people that my wife has been my partner for 73 years. And we've started 9 businesses. We sold 4. And one of the businesses that you will know that I started was what is the light store, Janan, on what is the light store on South Industrial? Okay. I started Gross Electric Company, and I sold that to the Gross Company 30-some years ago. So that was one of the businesses that I started. But anyway, I worked for the university, and when my family grew, and I realized that I could not provide educational opportunities for my children, and I had to do something else. I know that $70 a week would not provide the opportunities that I wanted my children to have. But what was I going to do? I had no skills. I had no training. I was not educated formally. How was I going to support my family? How was I going to give them the opportunities that I didn't have? And I had a thought. They were building a lot of houses on the west side of Ann Arbor, and the houses were being cleaned before the new owners took possession. And so I went to the builders of these homes, and I said, my name is John Barfield. I have a cleaning company. Let me clean these homes for you. So when the people move in, they will be moving into a new house, not a home that people have lived in for all the while it was being constructed. In those days when a house was built, when it rained, they'd sit inside and eat their dinners. They'd lean against the walls. They'd use the toilets. Sometimes they'd use the stove. Well, when you moved into that house, you weren't moving into a new house. You were moving into a house that had been lived in for 6 months before you got there. And I said, that's not good for your reputation. So they gave me an opportunity. And when I went in, I cleaned the houses. I washed the walls. I scrubbed the floors. I sanitized the floors. I cleaned and sanitized all of the facilities. And when I left those houses, it was poetry. These people moved in, and there are people today, 50 years later, that said, John, you cleaned my house over on the west side of town, and I never. In fact, I was driving from Ypsilanti on Hume River Drive, and I drove under the expressway, and I saw an older lady sitting in the yard, and I recognized it because I'd worked for her 40 years before, and I drove over, and I got out of the car, and I didn't want to surprise with a stranger walking into her yard, so I raised my hand, and I said, I know you don't know who I am, but I used to work. She said, I do know who you are. You're John Barfield. You used to wash my windows. And I said, the last time I washed your windows was 40 years ago. Your daughter was bringing a friend from New York, and you wanted everything to be perfect. And we sat there, and we had the nicest conversation. And the other day, I spoke at Glacier Hills, and a lot of the people said, John, do you remember when you washed my windows? Do any of you know Lois Stegman or Jack Stegman, who used to be a realtor? She said to me, John, tell a story about my husband. Well, the story about Mr. Stegman is he built that nice office on the corner of University and Washington. Oh, you know the white building that forms sort of an angle that you see as you drive down in Ann Arbor? And I went in one day and I said to him, Mr. Stegman, you've got a beautiful office. And he was a big man and he stood up and stretched himself and he said, well, John, there's nothing like traveling first class. So every time I see Lois Stegman, she said, John, tell that story. And that was it. But anyway, I started. And I made an interesting discovery. And I'm glad so many of you young people here, because you're going to make discoveries too. And I want you to listen very close to this. I made $70 a week cleaning for the University of Michigan. I cleaned toilets. I washed floors. I washed windows. I emptied trash. And I started cleaning these houses. And I found out that I could clean two houses in a day because I was young and strong then. And I got $35 a house. And it occurred to me, wow, I work for the university for a week and I make $70. If I work for myself, I make $70 in a day. So my income rose from $70 a week to $350 a week. But I found out something that was very important, that it's always good to think for yourself. And if you want to be successful in life, you have to know the value of your time and your talents, as opposed to letting other people tell you what you're worth. The University of Michigan told me I was worth $70 a week. When I began working for myself, I found out I was worth $350 a week. 13 years later, I left the university and started a corporation, which I sold 13 years later to International Telephone and Telegraph, and at the age of 39, I was able to retire. So what was I worth? Was I worth $30, $70 a week, or was I worth much more? And I want to tell you this. All your life, people will tell you what you're worth, but you have to know yourself. Let me tell you when that first occurred to me. I was 8 years old living in Pennsylvania, and my father was a coal miner. He worked in what they call the Lincoln Hill coal mine. It was known to be very dangerous. People died every day from cave-ins and from gases and all sorts of things. And one day, my cousin and I and some kids were playing. I was 9 years old. And all of a sudden, he found a $20 bill laying on the ground, just laying there. Now, this was a time when coal miners made $15 a week for working all week in a coal mine at $20. And we had this $20 bill, and we were all little kids, and we didn't know what to do with it. In fact, we were scared to death because what are we going to do with $20? So we decided we would not tell our folks because we were smart enough to know that if we told our folks, they would take it from us. So we weren't going to tell our folks. So we had to decide on how to divide the money. So my cousin has said I was too young to be in charge of it. And that was a mistake because I would have done it fairly. But we got his brother. And his brother saw this money. He was about 16 years old. And he really got excited. But he wasn't honest. So he took us to the store, and he got all this change, and he brought us back, and he put it in a pile, and he set us all in a circle, and he sat in the middle of the circle, and he gave the money out. But I noticed that his pile of money got bigger and bigger, and ours got smaller and smaller. So after a while, we probably had a dollar, and he had $18 or so. So I just said, you know, I don't want it, and I got up. Well, they figured when I got up that I was going to tell, so they said, he said, Johnny, come back. I'll give you more. And I said, no, I don't want it. Come on back. We'll give you more. I said, no, I don't want it. He got up and followed me, and I said, no, I don't want it. Because I felt that if I couldn't have what I was entitled to, I didn't want someone else giving me what I thought I should have. And that's a message that you should have. You're entitled to certain things in life. Don't let everyone tell you what you're worth or what you should have. That's for you to decide. So I went and told my uncle, and of course my uncle got very excited because that was a week's wages. He said, you go back and tell them to bring every penny to me and they better not spend a nickel of it. So I went back and they had to take all the money out of their pockets and they gave it to my uncle and we didn't have anything. I didn't have any candy all summer, but at least I had my dignity. Now my cousin was big and strong, so he stood behind my uncle's back and he balled up his fists and he said to me, in sign language, boom, boom, boom. And I know that if I didn't get some protection, I was going to be in bad shape. So, but I also knew how to use my resources. I said, Uncle Ernest, and he said, yes, Johnny, because I was now his favorite nephew. I said, James says he's going to really beat me up when you leave. He said, if he touches you, you tell me. So I was safe. So I learned how to use my resources at an early age. But anyway, over the years, I've started 9 different businesses, my wife and I. I'll tell you a little story about my wife and I. When my wife was 17 and I was 21, we decided I'd ask her mother if we could get married. So I had a hard time getting the nerve to ask her mother because her mother didn't like me. And I would walk my wife home from school and her mother would be sitting on the porch and I'd say, "Hi, Mrs. Walls," and she'd say, "Hi." You know, I said, "How are you, Mrs. Wall?" "Fine." So anyway, but I had a car and they didn't have a car, so I used to take her to work occasionally. And one day I was driving her to work, and this was the day that I made up my mind to ask her if I could marry her daughter. And I said, "Mrs. Walls," and we were in front of Arborland. I said, "Mrs. Walls," and she said, "What?" I said, "Can I please marry your daughter?" She said, "God, no." So I pulled off on the side of the road, and she said, "Why are you stopping?" I said, "So you can get out and walk the rest of the way to work." And that's a true story. Now, of course, I wasn't going to make her get out and walk the way to work, but it was enough to make her laugh, and she had this big laugh. And so for the next 40 years, I always told this story, and I said, the only way, I said, when we would have company, I said, "I don't know why my mother-in-law didn't like me." And I said, and she said, "Johnny, I did like you." And I said, "No, you didn't. The only reason you allowed me to marry your daughter was because you didn't want to walk to work that day." There's an end to that story. We've been together 73 years now, and it is a wedding that was made in heaven. My wife has been beside me for every step of this way. Every business that we started, she was a part of it. She's the best partner anyone could have it. And at this point, I'm going to ask you to say a prayer for my wife because she's not well. She had a stroke. So you pray that my wife her health will increase. But my mother-in-law was a wonderful lady, and she was very old-fashioned, and I always liked to play tricks on her. And one of the tricks I played on her was I bought her a swimming suit. She had never worn a swimming suit. She said, "Oh, God, Johnny, I couldn't wear that in public." I'd say, "Mom, with legs like those, you could wear a bikini. Get out of here," she'd say. I had a 40-foot cruiser on Lake St. Clair, and one day, Betty and I were with her mother, and I said, "Mom, you're gonna drive the boat today." "Oh, God, Johnny, I couldn't drive this boat." "Yes, you can. Mom, sit here." I put her in the captain's chair, and I said, "This is the throttle. If you want to go fast, you push it down. If you want to go slow, you pull it back." "Johnny, I can't do it." "Yes, you can." So Betty and I were sitting in the back laughing. She had beautiful white hair, and it was streaming, and she was going down the road, and she pushed the throttle, and the boat bared down and started going. She pushed a little bit more. And 5 minutes later, she had it full throttle going on Lake St. Clair, you know, tears coming out of her eyes, and she was having a good time. But it was like that. It was just a joy to spoil her. And when she died, a day or so before my mother-in-law died, Betty and I, my wife and I, were in the room with her, and we knew she was leaving us. And she was looked at me with sort of fixed stare, and I said, "Mom, why are you looking at me like that?" She said, "Because nobody has ever had a better son-in-law." Isn't that a nice story? But anyway, in 1975, there were no black businesses in this country. I got a very interesting call from General Motors asking me if I would meet with them and to explore an idea. I met with them, and they said, "We would like for you to help us find minorities and women that we could buy goods and services from." We looked for 1 year, and we found only one black business in Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor, and that was a man that sold corrugated boxes. So in those days, there were no opportunities for people of color or for women in this country. And so we were pioneers. We started. So they called me over to their office, and they said, "John, we'd like to give you an order for 6 employees to clean up some old and tattered engineering drawings. And if you can prove to us that you can do this over a period of 6 months, we'd like to continue to give you opportunities." That was 40 years ago in 1975. We hired 6 kids from the community college, and we started the Bartech Group. Today, that company has 650 employees. We provide technical training services for 35,000 technical employees of companies like Citibank, Verizon, Kaiser Permanente, and others. We have operations in Belgium, England, London, Canada, Mexico, and the United States. And last, in 2014, our company was named the best managed services corporation in the world, outperforming Kelly Services, Manpower, Adecco, and others. So that's a brief summation of our company and my 65-year entrepreneurial journey here in Ypsilanti. So I'm going to quit now, and if you have questions, I'd like to answer those.
Give them a hand.
I'm sorry I interrupted the applause there. If someone raises their hand, I can bring a mic around. And
Yeah, about 15, 20 years ago, I was an independent contractor. And I remember I did work at your house, and you had these paintings.
Yes.
Where you had sponsored these artists.
Yes.
The different artists and stuff
yes.
like that.
Yes.
You still do that, or you still collect?
Thank you for giving me an opportunity to tell that story. In 1975, there was a black artist who was not very well known. His name was Paul Collins. He was from Kalamazoo. And I built my office in downtown Ypsilanti. In those days, the banks would not lend money to African Americans. I was the first African American in Ypsilanti that was able to get a loan from the banks. The people that built houses used to build them by buying blocks, piling them up, and we got enough blocks, they'd dig a hole, and they would lay blocks, and they would put tar on the outside, and they'd live in that until they got money. That's how many of those houses were built. So in 1975, when I left the University of Michigan and I started my own business, I wanted to build a business that African Americans could be very proud of. So I bought a three-story building on Michigan Avenue that was once belonged to Schaefer Hardware, and that became my office. And at that time, in 1975, I met this artist. His name was Paul Collins. He was struggling. He's not struggling anymore. He's world-renowned now, and he's collected by many people. In fact, he did a portrait of Gerald Ford when he was in the White House. That was quite unusual. But when I met him, nobody knew him. But I saw he was struggling, and I decided that I would put a collection of African-American art in my office downstairs. So I sent him to Harlem, New York, to do pictures of, that's what you saw, of people living on the streets of Harlem. And he came back with 19 drawings. And I said, my God, this work is phenomenal. I said, do you have any more work? And he said, yes, because a lot of people were not collecting him. So I started collecting him. And the long and short of the story is now I have the largest collection of his works in the world. Out more than Amway has, more than anyone. And I sent him to Africa for a year to paint the Maasai people because it was a dying culture. And I sent him there for a year to do that. And when I decided to quit collecting art, I gave that collection to the African American Museum in Detroit. And the end of the story is Toledo University saw it, and they said, Mr. Barfield, would you ask him if they could put that on a permanent display in our world-class medical library? I asked, and they did. So if you want to see something that's absolutely unbelievable, you go and you look at this library, which has to be at least 10,000 square feet, and there's 90 pieces of art in that I gave to the museum. And it's all over there, and it was something that I've been very proud of because I was able to give this artist a chance to have his museum. He invited me to Cuba with my family, and we saw some of his work there. But I have the largest collection of his works anywhere, and I've just given that there. And now he has his own private art collection at Toledo University. So it was an opportunity to help someone that was struggling. Thank you. Any other questions?
Another question?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hang on just a moment.
Mm-hmm. I read your book, and I was very impressed with it, and all the things that you've done and the kinds of things that you've grown from just starting out from your mm-hmm. cleaning company into what you've gone into. And you've been all around. You've mm-hmm. been into Detroit. You were helping out in certain areas. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about do we have any black entrepreneurs in Detroit area that are able to do the kinds of things? Do they get the help that they would need in order to achieve the kind of things that you have?
Oh, I'm sure that I'm not an exception. There are a lot of entrepreneurs there that, but I don't. Most of my work has been around here. I decided that profit is not only measured in the number of dollars you make; it's measured in the number of good things you do for other people. And I was raised to believe that if God blesses me to be successful, I should share my success with other people. So I've just had my own charities. I've built wells in Nigeria, Haiti, Malawi, Zambia. I underwrote the medical and dental program for people living off the dumps in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. When they had the cholera outbreak in Zambia, I was one of three companies that built enough wells to provide water for 18,000 people a day. We underwrote a project in Malawi for a prison that allowed the prisoners to raise crops and vegetables, have livestock, half of which they consume, the other half they sold, they could have better lives. So what I've tried to do is I've tried to share my good fortune with less fortunate people. I read a story once about a man named Abu Ben Adams. Have you all heard that story? This poem goes, Abu Ben Adam, may his tribe increase, awoke one night from a deep dream of peace and saw an angel in his room writing a book, names in a book of gold. And exceeding peace made Ben Adam bold, and he said to the angel, what are you writing? And the angel said, the names of all the people that love the Lord. And Abu said, is my name one? And he said, no, you're not numbered there. And he says, I pray that you name me as one that loves his fellow man. And Abu said the angel disappeared, and the next night he came back in a blazing loom of light, and he read the names of all the people that God had blessed, and lo, Abu's name led all the rest. I learned early that the way to have a closer relationship with God is by serving your fellow man to the best of your ability. And to me, that means sharing what I had. When I wrote the book, the author, that the man that helped me write the book, insisted on me talking about my wealth and my accomplishments, and I said, no. This book has to be written with humility and deference. I want people to realize that I am where I am by the grace of God, and not because I worked harder or I'm smarter or anything like that. And I hope that's the message you got when you read the book. I've tried to share my good fortune with less fortunate people, and that's been it. The proceeds from the book, every penny from the book is going to go to provide polio vaccinations. I have been able to raise my family, to give them educations, and to give them opportunities that I never had myself. And everything else that I can do in life that I can share with other people, this is what I want to do. We just made a $200,000 gift to the Park Ridge Community Center. It's a center in a very impoverished part of Ypsilanti that was going to close down because the city could not support it. For 10 years now, we've raised the funds to keep it open. And I was able to get a memorandum of understanding between Washtenaw Community College and the city of Ypsilanti, and we're starting an endowment fund that would assure for years to come that center would be there to serve that community. I think that's what we should do as people. We should share. If we've been blessed to have a good life, we should do everything we can to bless the lives of less fortunate people. And that's the joy I get out of life. Are there any other questions?
Someone else? No? Okay, well, okay. We will be having a book signing here, and there are books available right in the hallway, so we hope you take advantage of that. And let's give one more. Oh, I'm sorry. Does someone have a question? Oh, okay.
One thing I did hear you say in the talk is that your business eventually grew to 650 employees. But it's 3,000 employees.
Yes.
Is that right? I just wanted to get clarity.
Yeah. It's grown to 3,000 employees. Thank you, Janen.
Okay. Oh, and I do have another question.
Okay. I want to ask you a question about today's world now. I mean, like, we're in the computer area, you know, like computer, internet, stuff like that. So people have so many opportunities to become an entrepreneur, but it's kind of hard to, when you start doing this kind of thing, to check and see who else is doing what you're doing. And I think everybody should try to come up with something new, because we definitely need something new now to get us out of this situation we've been following the leader with the internet.
Yep.
And trying to say they're doing a lot of things, but I think a lot of people are faking it, you know. For us, you know, like, say we went to the moon and stuff like that, but the condition here on Earth doesn't show no proof that we've been anywhere, you know. I mean, like, we're doing the same thing. I mean, like, common peoples, you know, like, what happened to the extraordinary people that find a solution for that kind of thing, yeah. You know? That's what I'm saying, like, well, somebody got to come up with something new and make this thing work, because it's not working for us.
Well, let me tell you something I discovered. The if I had stayed at the University of Michigan the rest of my working career, I wouldn't have been able to do half as much as I've been able to do. The secret to getting ahead in life is spending some of the hours of your life working not only for other people, but working for yourself. In your lifetime, in the lifetime of everyone in this room, you're going to work a total of about 84,000 hours. That's the amount of time that you have to sell. What you sell that time for will determine whether you will be well off or whether you will be poor. If I had spent all of my 84,000 hours working for the University of Michigan, I would have been poor, because I wouldn't have made enough to get ahead. But I discovered that in order for me to get ahead in life, I had to spend some of that time working for myself. So one of the things we're trying to teach people is to practice part-time entrepreneurship. Now, it's dangerous to venture off full-time in entrepreneurship, because most businesses are going to fail. We know that. But there's nothing wrong with using part of your 84,000 hours to work for yourself. So what I've been trying to teach people, that if they work for themselves, they can make money. I did a chart once that said a skilled employee that worked and made $30 an hour and worked for 40 years would end up with only enough money to provide them to have a good retirement, but they would not build wealth. But if you worked as an entrepreneur on a part-time basis, you have an opportunity to build wealth. And that's what I try to encourage people to do, to at least spend part of their time working for themselves.
No. Okay.
Then let me conclude by saying to the young people here today, you're young, you're just starting your lives out. I would advise you all to think about the possibility of at least at some point in your life working for yourself. It's a good way to move forward in life, and if you do that, I think you'll be very pleased with your future. Thank you.
John, actually, I think we have a couple more questions here, so I'm sorry.
I'm just sort of curious, if I may ask, how large your family has grown. How many children did you raise? How many grandchildren do you have? And what did you learn from parenthood versus your working career?
I have six children. We have six children. Three boys and three girls. Our oldest is 63 years old. Our youngest is 43 years old. We have 12 grandchildren, and we have six great-grandchildren. Everything that I know I learned from my parents. They taught me principles that has sustained me all of my life. I would not be where I am if I had not had good parents that taught me these principles. Watch who you associate with. Work hard to get ahead. Remember that someone is always watching you. If you do a good job, all you should expect is a good wage. People that get ahead in life are those people that exceed the expectations of the people they work for or serve. These were the things that helped me. But let me just close with a five-minute thing. Another man, I'm giving a speech on the 19th Father's Day for a church in Ypsilanti, and we were talking today about what I would say. And what I will say to them is that we are not only fathers to our own children, we're fathers to other children as well. When I was 9 years old, I met a man. His name was Robert Lutton. And my father was a coal miner. He worked every day in the coal mine. He came home every day black with sweat. My mother would have buckets of water on the stove. He'd sit in the middle of the kitchen floor, take a bath. Mother would scrub his back. He'd put on clean clothes and come to the table to eat. My father would be so tired many of the times that he would fall asleep before he finished his meal. And I saw no future for me except a job in the coal mines. But I had a newspaper route. And one of the men on my newspaper route was a man named Robert Lutton. And I used to love to stop by his store and talk with him. That was my last visit because I saw a man that came to work in a shirt and a tie. He had his own business. And when I contrasted his lifestyle with that of my father's, I decided at the age of 9 that someday, by the grace of God, I was going to be like him. I was going to grow up. I was going to aspire to have my own business. I was going to go to work every day with a shirt and tie. I was not going to work in the coal mines. And I had that all my life. So while I had good natural parents, I had other parents like Mr. Lutton that taught me lessons. And Mr. Lutton saw that I was interested. And let me tell you what he did for me. I said to him in time, Mr. Lutton, could I work for you? And he would sit in his chair and he'd look at me and stroke his chin and he'd say, well, now, Johnny, what do you think you could do for me? And I said, well, I could sweep the floor. And he said, you think you could sweep the floor? And I said, yes, sir. So it wasn't long I'd be sweeping the floor. And then I said, Mr. Lutton, can I help you load the soap? Because he took soap out of a 55-gallon barrel and put it in little cracker jack-sized boxes. And I was doing that. And then I was putting it up. I learned by the time I was 10 years old, I could honestly run his business as well as he could. I could clean his shop, I could package his product, I could take care of his inventory. And one day I said, Mr. Lutton, can I sell this to? And he stroked his chin and said, now, Johnny, do you think you could sell my soap? And I said, yes, sir. So I'd load my paper bag up with soap, and I'd put it on my shoulder. I had sense enough to go to the wealthiest part of Washington, Pennsylvania. I didn't go to the poor sections because they couldn't buy the soap. So I'd go over and I'd knock on the door, and a lady would come and say, hi, son, what can I do for you? And I'd say, my name is Johnny Barfield. I sell clean and lean soap. Would you please buy some from me? And they more likely than not would say, well, how many do you have? And I said, I've got 14 more boxes. And they would say, why don't I take all of that, son? I can put it on my shelf. Well, they saw I was a little poor kid struggling, and they would buy all of the soap. And Mr. Lutton gave me a 5-cent commission for every box that I sold, and I would run back and get another box of soap. So when my friends were selling newspapers and doing that, this man was teaching me how to be an entrepreneur. And in the book, I have a picture of him. His name was Robert Lutton. And I say in that book that I owe my success as an entrepreneur more to Mr. Lutton than to anyone else, because it was my exposure to him that taught me to be an entrepreneur. And that is one of the programs we're starting at Park Ridge. We're teaching the kids from 9 to 12 years old how to think like entrepreneurs and business leaders, because that's where it happens. You know, I'm on the advisory board for the University of Michigan Entrepreneur Program. I've been on the same board for Eastern Michigan. I've done it also for Chinook Community College. And the mistake I think that we make in this country, we don't start training our people to think that way until they're grown. That is not the time. The time to do it when I learned, when I was 9 years old, to excite these kids. So we're teaching the kids at Park Ridge. I hope that it can be expanded to the whole community of Ypsilanti, and I proposed that the other night at the city council. And I told them that if they would approve the program, I would make a gift of $240,000 and we'd start this program. So my goal, by the grace of God, is to teach these kids when they're 9 to 12 years old how to think like entrepreneurs. Because if you don't do that, they'll be no better off when they get to be old folks. They will still think the way they think because no one is training them. So I ask your prayers that my experiment will be successful and there will be other people that will grow up to become entrepreneurs and business leaders. Thank you very much.